It is truly a pleasure to welcome you this morning to Vanderbilt University Law School, as well as to say a few opening remarks for this really fascinating symposium. I'm particularly delighted to be welcoming you because it seems like such a fabulous and interesting and important topic. The future of the Arctic, I think, brings together a rich array of issues. At bottom, it seems to raise a question about the capacity of existing legal regimes and even existing legal categories to address the challenges for this region along a wide variety of dimensions, including the human and development rights of the peoples indigenous to the region, the management of environmental resources of the region, stewardship of the energy resources of the region, complex issues of maritime and transportation safety, the management of global fisheries, and strategic military interests. I'm also particularly delighted to welcome you because the assembled participants in this symposium were so carefully chosen and so distinguished and represent such a nice cross-section of policymakers, government officials, lawyers, and academics. Each of you, I think, brings an important piece of the puzzle and perspective on it. I know many of you have traveled far to be here, and we are truly grateful for your coming, knowing that all of you have such busy schedules, and we're honored that you're here with us today. I hope it's a valuable day with plenty of new connections for all of you and renewed connections for some of you, as well as for those of us in the law school. I also hope for those of you who imagined this symposium many months ago that you feel very, very pleased with the day that's about to transpire. And in that regard, I'd like to do a couple specific thank yous. I'd like to thank Peter Marshall for all his hard work, Megan Benton, Angelina Carmignetti, Allison Holt, Tyler Hagenbush, Rachel Vrade, my colleague Larry Helfer, my colleague Ingrid Wirth, my colleague Will Martin, of course our dedicated administrator Faye Johnson. So I hope you have a really terrific day and welcome to Vanderbilt Law School. So without further ado, the first one.
Well, good morning, everyone. I'm Professor Larry Helfer. I'm the director of the International Legal Studies Program here at Vanderbilt, and I'm delighted to be moderating this first panel today on the Continental Shelf. I will keep my remarks very brief. I see my role, as after saying a few introductions, as keeping us to our timetable. We have an hour and 45 minutes for discussion, or about that. The panelists have been asked to keep their remarks to between 15 and no more than 20 minutes each. And the reason for that is to allow discussion both among the panelists and also among the audience members. It's really wonderful to have all of you here in the room on this topic, some of the leading lights on these issues, both the legal scholars, scientists, UN officials, government officials, policymakers. We have a very diverse array of perspectives and deep expertise on these issues. And so I'm really grateful, and I'm looking forward to learning. I will just give you one sort of, you didn't think there could be any sort of trivia about Vanderbilt and the law of the sea, but in fact, there is. Some of the students in particular won't know this. The panelists probably will. Jonathan Charney, who taught here for 30 years until his death in 2002, I believe, among his many areas of expertise were the law of the sea and issues relating to boundary disputes. And he had a real deep knowledge of that. And so I know that I'm delighted that we can be able to continue his legacy by having this discussion today. Further ado, I'll just very briefly introduce your panelists. I'm not going to say much about their backgrounds. They are in your materials, so you can, I couldn't do justice to them. That would take the full hour and 45 minutes, and I don't want to do that. One note, we will be sort of changing the order just a little bit. We'll begin with Professor Nordquist, who is a senior fellow at the Center for National Security Law at UVA, among many other things. He will give us a broader overview of some of the issues. We will then turn to Vladimir Jarez, who is a senior officer with the Division for Ocean Affairs and the Law of the Sea in the Office of Legal Affairs of the UN Secretariat. He has been active in Law of the Sea negotiations and implementation issues for many years. We'll then turn next to Larry Mayer, who will give us a, sort of a scientific perspective on some of these issues. And also sort of how that blends with the legal. And again, he has very deep expertise in oceanography and marine geophysics issues, so I can't imagine a better person to be on this panel for these issues. And last but by no means least, John Noyes, professor at Cal Western, someone whose writings span not just the law of the sea, but also a variety of issues, including public international law generally and international dispute resolution. That's how I know of his work principally. And so he will talk about the very important issue of dispute settlement and the outer limits of the continental shelf. So without further ado, let me turn the floor over to Professor Nordquist, who will get us started on some of these issues. I confess that I think some of the developments here have been happening so recently. I'm just reading the, sort of the précis of his remarks. I learned three things I didn't know about recent developments, so I'm sure we're going to learn much more. So without further ado, Professor Nordquist.
Thank you very much. Excuse me. Thank you very much, Larry. John Charney was a dear friend of mine, and I have never been to Vanderbilt Law School before. I know he loved it here, and I now can understand why. John was one of the most important people in the academic world of law of the sea. The reason that he, in particular, led a very large project for the American Society of International Law that is on basically in a multi-volume series covering all of the maritime boundary agreements. That is a very important area you'll hear much more about. I think, and most people don't realize it, the majority of the cases that the International Court of Justice has had have concerned maritime boundaries. So John performed seminal and important work, and he did it right here. So I'm especially pleased to be here and to, in a sense, kind of remember him. My comments are going to some extent, lay a bit of a foundation for things that follow. I'm going to take a rather pedestrian walk through what the UNCLOS continental shelf regime is about, since our panel is on that topic. I'm then going to comment on some rather far-reaching developments that have occurred in the last 6 weeks in the United States with respect to Arctic policy and even judicial decision. And then lastly, I'm going to comment on the hydrocarbon potential, why so much attention besides the unique environmental issues, why there's a lot at stake financially in the Arctic. The UN Convention, of course, now has 155 parties. It is contained in 320 articles, 9 annexes. Extraordinarily complex document, should be, because it attempts to set a comprehensive regime for 70% of the Earth's surface. The Continental Shelf articles are in Part 6, and there are 10 articles. And I'm just going to very briefly, as foundation, mention what they do. The first one I will only say is Article 76, which attempts to define the continental shelf. As we get through the day here, we'll find that the job it does is a little bit less than adequate. Terms such as foot of the slope, which is an important element in it, are almost impossible to define. But we have the best in the world, literally, and Larry Mayer here, who is going to tell us what he's been doing up in the Arctic, which is just mind-boggling. And I should also mention that the article originated, I suppose, with the Truman Proclamation, which was issued shortly after World War II, particularly down in the Louisiana area. The U.S. had been moving more and more into offshore areas as oil was needed for the war effort. And at the end of the war, Truman unilaterally declared that the offshore resources that we could exploit were under the jurisdiction and control of the United States, and there were no protests to that claim. I'm sure nobody really appreciated what it was going to lead to. The next major development occurred, legally speaking, I suppose, when the UN got up and running and the International Law Commission set about the progressive codification of international law. And the International Law Commission, the first thing they really turned to was law of the sea, because that is, after all, the foundation for international law. And they took up continental shelf articles, which they prepared. These articles then were presented in draft form to the first conference on the law of the sea in 1958, resulting in the Convention on the Continental Shelf. The next development of the major concept of the continental shelf occurred in 1969 in the North Sea continental shelf cases, which declared the most fundamental principle pertaining to the continental shelf, and that is that the coastal state regime is out to the natural prolongation of the landmass. And most important about that concept is that you don't have to declare it, you just got it. It's parcel of the domination of the sovereign state over the land territory. This concept has somewhat gotten forgotten as the efforts have been made to go ever farther seaward. And we will see when the conversations turn to the Commission on the Continental Shelf that there's plenty of room for controversy over what parts of the seaward continental shelf, in the legal sense, really do belong to the adjacent coastal state. The next article, and I'm going to then stop with that because we're going to hear lots about Article 76 today. The next article is Article 77, which really states that the coastal state has exclusive rights, and that, again, quoting the language in the convention, which, by the way, just picked up verbatim in almost every case what was in the 1958 convention. It states that the rights do not depend upon, I'm quoting, do not depend upon occupation, effective or notional, or on any express proclamation. Also notes that the customary law rule that sedentary species like king crab and oysters are considered natural resources of the continental shelf and fall under the continental shelf regime. A particular importance for the melting of the ice in the Arctic is the rule that's in Article 78, that the continental shelf rights do not affect the legal status of the superadjacent waters. This is going to be, again, a subject of a lot of attention and, to some extent, some controversy. But we have a panel that is going to be focused on that, and it'll be interesting to hear the views, because Canada and the United States sometimes have different views about that. There is another really neglected issue that that arises in Article 79, and that has to do with the freedom of laying submarine cables and pipelines. Now, pipelines are one thing, and cables are quite another. But what many people don't realize is that almost all of the traffic in between countries, the data that banks send back and forth, go through submarine cables. And now when, and these things are only about that big. So they're long, but they really, really have a de minimis impact on, I mean, you might occasionally settle on a lobster head or something, but it really is an important element as in the last 20 years we've become so globally interconnected. And it's interesting, if you Google that topic, you won't find many articles that scholars have written on this subject. It will be increasingly important, not necessarily in the Arctic, but somewhat maybe in the Arctic, as cables break. You know, we had tsunamis that broke cables, and they practically shut down China for a while. And we had one that broke in the Middle East, and it cut off India. So you can't really have a global economy if you don't have that kind of communication. And of course, all your friends that are in those places that tried to send out their emails, suddenly found that they could not. Anyway, it's a topic that I think warrants quite a bit more attention and more appreciation. I won't mention much about Articles 80 and 81. That deal with artificial installations and drilling on the shelf, respectively. Article 82 is a unique article, and again, one that scholars ought to look at and will start to look at, because it deals with payments and contributions to the International Seabed Authority as a result of oil and gas exploitation beyond 200 nautical miles. The reason this is kind of interesting is that, of course, the International Seabed Authority has nothing to do with oil and gas exploration, but they had to get some kind of political compromise, and on the other side of every continental shelf, outer continental shelf delimitation, is the International Seabed Authority. People forget they're a party, and they have been deliberately excluded from any kind of participation in the Continental Shelf Commission deliberations, which is certainly unfair, but again, the conference was dominated by the people that thought they had something to gain, and it remains to be seen whether remains an exclusive province of the coastal states, and this is particularly going to arise in the Arctic. I think it's predictable that the Arctic bordering states, five of them, and three that certainly have airspace or other interests, such as Sweden, Finland, and Iceland, will not want any more outsiders. They're going to have enough trouble with each other, are having enough trouble with each other, especially with Russia. So they're going to want to keep it within, politically, within the confines of the 1982 convention, and it is likely that they will make some compromises to be sure that that legal framework fits for their problems. Second to last, the issue of delimitation is touched on in Article 83 of the convention. Delimitation is basically insoluble multilaterally unless the concerned states go to the international dispute settlement, which John will talk about, and they aren't very eager to do that. But it is interesting that was one of the most intractable issues at the conference, and indeed the solution that was finally bought off on is classic ambiguity. What negotiators do is when they can't agree, they push until they get to something that's so ambiguous that everybody agrees. And that's what they did in the Article 83. They said that that the idea is to achieve an equitable solution. So they didn't try to get into methods in as they did with the outer limit business, but they simply said, got to have an equitable solution. Well, I mean, it's hard to disagree with that. So it's in the Article 83. Now, maybe it has a little more meaning than I'm giving credit to it, but we'll hear more. Article 84 is a housekeeping rule that mandates that the limits be drawn on charts or lists of coordinates and that these be deposited with the UN. And then finally, as kind of a little afterthought, Article 85, the last of the 10 articles, deals with the tunneling and basically confirms the traditional rights to for coastal states to tunnel for continental shelf resources. This is in places like Wales, where they have tunnels that go deeply, well, go out into the continental shelf. Okay, so I've already indicated that I think this these 10 articles are going to be applied. The states with the most special interests do have an important role. It's recognized in international law. So a state that doesn't have anything but maybe a seat at the UN is not expected to have as much to say about the forming of the law that affects the states that are directly concerned. It's the way customary law has always been. I have distributed, I didn't quite have enough, I don't think, but a graphic depiction. You'll note that that belongs to Larry Mayer, and at least he has to defend it now. But he tells me that it's already out of date, which is wonderful news for us, because the red is spreading. The red menace is spreading, and particularly off New Hampshire with its, 23 miles of coastline? Oh, 16, geez. Overstated it, gosh. Anyway, I now will turn to my my next major topic, which will I'll only touch upon lightly because it's in more of the nature of an announcement and encouraging you to go look at it yourself. But in earlier this, well, not this month, but in January, President Bush on January 9th issued a directive on the subject of Arctic region policy. And I'm not going to go into the content of it except to say that it's a very comprehensive statement, and it will remain to be seen how much of it is followed in the new administration. And it certainly is noteworthy that it took so long to get it out, as pointed out by the head of the Coast Guard. But this this is it does have implications for the law of the sea. For example, for those of you that are interested in environmental aspects of it, you'll see that there are subtle things that are put in there, such as the incorporation of the precautionary principle via the Fish Stocks Agreement, which goes into the Law of the Sea Convention, where there's no mention whatsoever of precautionary. Nor was there any negotiation about it. My final, well, more or less final topic has to do with the hydrocarbon resource potential in the Arctic Basin. The Geological Survey last year estimated that a fifth, 20% of the world's undiscovered oil and gas reserves are in the Arctic Basin. That, by anybody's measure, it means that it's the largest unexplored potential area for offshore oil and gas. 13% of the world's undiscovered oil and 30% of its undiscovered gas are said to be out there. The Russians are overwhelmingly the biggest player. That is to say, the estimates that they have are 10 times those of the United States, which is the distant second under the estimates. My last topic has to do with the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act. The idea here is that the United States has a four-stage process that it follows, and making sure that development out in the offshore area is in compliance with the National Environmental Policy Act. After spending $2.5 billion in the previous 3 years, Shell Oil was stopped by the Ninth Circuit on November 20th in the Alaska Wilderness League case because, in a divided opinion, they were deemed not to have given sufficient attention to the disruption that would occur to the migratory patterns of bowhead whales. So we can see that America has got some major interests that will be at play. This will undoubtedly be appealed. Let me at the end just say that the U.S. follows the convention in some ways more ardently and more literally than most of the states that are parties. There's no risk that we will lose our inherent rights to the continental shelf. The only issue is how far out they go, and it will be necessary, and this is one of the strongest reasons for the U.S. to accede to the convention, to become a party so that confirmation of the outer reach of the shelf beyond 200 miles will be confirmed. And that isn't because we don't already have the rights. It is because banks will not lend money in the billions of dollar category unless they have the security of tenure that only can be gotten from having the holy water sprinkled from the Continental Shelf Commission. So I think what's likely in the short term is that we'll see some momentum carrying on with the announcements that Bush has made. I didn't mention all of the things that recently were done at the end of his term. It is fairly predictable that the Obama administration will have a while before it gets geared up, and then it is likely to put a greater emphasis on the environmental and global warming aspects and less probably enthusiasm for offshore drilling, but we can bet that the national interests and certainly the private interests are sufficient that the next few years will be very interesting in the Arctic Basin. Thank you.
We'll next hear from Vladimir Harris, who will speak to us about the Continental Shelf beyond 200 meters, the work of the Commission on the Arctic.
You know how to use it.
Very much. I don't know whether you can hear me. I'll try to speak from this perspective because I'm some mapping, and it'll be more easier for me to show it on the screen. First, I would like to express our sincere thanks and gratitude to the Vanderbilt Journal of Transnational Law and to the Vanderbilt Law School for inviting the Division for Ocean Affairs and the Law of the Sea, which is part of the Office of Oceanic Affairs of the United Nations. In a way, it's a privilege for us to have this opportunity to introduce our work to the American audience, which we don't get so often. Also, I would like to say that I'm humbled also by the presence of other presenters and panelists. Among them, I would like to mention Ambassador Hans Corell, who used to be the legal counsel for the United Nations and my boss. John Hunter Moore and Myron Orkis, who are eminent scholars in the field of the law of the sea and who will be probably having a lot of critical remarks on what I'm going to say. And of course, I would like to mention that John Charney Alexander, five volume, it's sitting on my bookshelf behind me. And yeah, and your two, yeah. And it's on a very precious.
Sorry, if you just move the cursor, it'll be. Good.
Okay. I apologize.
Yeah,
that's all right. Let me just Anyway, I'm going to continue with my introductory statement. So also I would like to, as a good lawyer, make a disclaimer. Whatever I say here cannot be attributed to the United Nations. I am expressing my personal views on these matters, and that should stay at that. And also I would like to acknowledge, when this screen comes up, the contribution of my colleagues, GIS officers with our division, Robert Sandiff and Sean Stanley, who had been instrumental in providing this kind of... Okay, losing microphone, losing... Thank you. Who have been very helpful in creating some of these images and also the design of the presentation, which hopefully will be back in a while. I would like to state at the outset that the United Nations Conventions, it was a package deal, and this is something that we have to remember. It established a legal regime governing all ocean space. The status of the convention actually is it's now higher than 155. We have 157 states parties due to the recent ratification by accession, I think, by Congo and by Liberia, or ratification, one of them. So, including the European community. The part, of course, the package deal was so sensitive, so delicate, that when in the early 90s, the Secretary General convened the consultations on Part 11 on the deep sea mining regime, they didn't dare to call it an amendment, so it became an implementation agreement. And that's an overview of my presentation. I'll just skip through that. And this is something which is very important, because the part on the continental shelf is part of this package deal, and that's a result of very close relationship between all these elements, freedoms of the sea, and also entitlements or sovereign rights of the coastal state over the resources of the oceans. So that's something which I wanted to highlight. Now, coming to the maritime zones, just for basic understanding, what is really important here, that land governs the sea. Without a sovereignty over land territory, and without a sovereignty over the land territory here, there is no sovereignty over the territorial sea, and there is no entitlement whatsoever, sovereign rights or jurisdiction in the outer limits. And that's what we have to understand also, because we have situations when states are in dispute over the sovereignty over islands, for instance, or even land territory. Without that, it's impossible to continue this exercise for them to see. One of the very important feature is the baselines. Here you have the information on the maximum extent of the maritime zones, territorial sea contiguous zone, and exclusive economic zone, the regime of which, in a sense, overlaps with that of the continental shelf. Today, I'm going to focus on what happens beyond this limit of the 200 nautical miles, and with a special focus on the Arctic. To understand the scheme of Article 76, I'm going to use a slide prepared by a member of the Commission, Mr. Harald Brekke from Norway. There is a difference between the continental shelf as used in the scientific terms and the continental shelf as defined in UNCLOS. And the difference is that the definition of Article 76 is based on the definition of the continental shelf as the natural prolongation of land territory, and more importantly, up to the end of the continental margin. And the definition of the continental margin actually comprises shelf, slope, and rise. So that's the difference. The legal continental shelf contains the shelf in the scientific sense of this word, slope and rise. And of course, we have this feature which has been already mentioned, which is the foot of the continental slope, which is defined as the maximum change of gradient between the slope and rise. And of course, the scheme is, this is the ideal scheme, when you can actually calculate quite reliably this foot of the slope. But of course, in the real life, it's much more complicated. The seabed is very complex. You have plenty of features which interfere. So we have to come to certain mathematics derivatives, second and derivatives, which try to illustrate actually the maximum mathematically calculated change in gradient. The outer edge of the continental margin is determined by way of two methods, and the names attached to these methods is Gardiner and Hedberg. These two formulas and criteria which are used by the convention and which show which also demonstrate the entitlement of the coastal state to the continental shelf beyond 200 miles are based on the foot of the continental slope, and one is measured by 60 miles by arcs of 60 miles from the foot of the continental slope. The other method uses a distance, 1% of sediment thickness, which is 1% of the distance to the foot of the continental slope. This is, of course, the most complex, a more complex method, because it requires the coastal state to spend enormous amount of money on sounding, on exploring the sediments. And of course, part of it's done by the industry when looking for oil and gas, but this is closer to the shore. Here you have to go beyond 200 miles, and the expenses run into millions of dollars. Australia spent undisclosed, but quite important amount of money of mapping the seabed and the sediments under the seabed and the sediment thickness. So in a way, although the drafters of the convention wanted to find some kind of independent scientific method, they've done a certain disservice, I would say, to many of the coastal states, especially developing countries. You do not have the potential. They don't have vessels. They don't have money. They don't have capacity. They don't have how to go and how to find the sediment thickness and how to calculate it and measure it, which is probably the better matter for, in many cases, many situations. This is what gives you more. In some cases, the coastal state may not reach beyond 200 miles with this criteria, but may go beyond 200 miles based on the sediment thickness. So this is a real issue which I just wanted to highlight. Now, this is something which you'll find in the scientific technical guidelines of the Commission. There's a scheme, and if you understand this scheme, I think that you'll be on your way to become a member of the Commission, and I think that I'll stop at that. It basically illustrates the various methods and constraints, and I should come back to the constraint slide, which was here, that actually the maximum distance could be either 350 from the baselines, and hence the importance of the baselines for the continental shelf beyond 200 miles, or other maximum line which stops actually states from going too far. These lines are not to determine the continental margin, these are to stop the state for having an excessive claim or excessive situation. This is 350, and or the 2,500 meter isobars plus 100 nautical miles, and that's it. Now, this being said, I would like to stress, and this is directly relevant to the Arctic, the North Submarine Ridges, only that constraint applies, and that's something which is, as you will later see, crucial for at least one coastal state in its submission to the Commission. Now, this is what the drafters of the Convention saw in 1978. And that's a map illustrating the potential expansion of the continental shelf beyond 200 nautical miles, and this is the shaded area. And you can also compare it to the map which you have been just seen, which has been circulated. And this is what assisted them in accepting the Article 76 as it's drafted right now. It's available on our website, so I'm not going to go into details. What I would like to say that the draft of the convention also, and it wasn't an afterthought, but I was told actually it happened very fast, the drafting for Annex II and establishment of the commission. They created an independent body of experts. And this is the Commission on the Limit of the Continental Shelf. And that's for one reason, because the delineation of outer limits of maritime zones as calculated from the baselines, unless you have to delimit with a neighboring or opposite state, it's a unilateral act of the coastal state. You don't need anybody else for that. It can be protested and objected against, but basically it's a unilateral act. In this situation, when you go beyond the simple calculation, I'm of course exaggerating, of 200 nautical miles, the international community thought it necessary to have an independent body of experts who would verify that the criteria of the convention have been correctly applied. Hence, the commission, and then two functions. First, to consider the data and the submissions, basically. And second, under use or not used at all, this is to assist coastal states, and I think that was the issue of developing countries, assisting them in doing that. There are 21 of them, as I said. They are in their personal capacity. The affiliation with the UN is by the way of that we are providing services, of course. It's a convention body of experts. They are not representing the United Nations. They are not supposed to represent their countries and the interests of their countries, even though a number of them are actually experts for their governments. This has to be disclosed when the submission comes in, if they assisted in the preparation of the submission. But they function by the way of subcommissions. When examining the submissions of individual coastal states, they split into small groups of seven, and then they proceed with the examination. The current chair of the commission is Mr. Albuquerque from Brazil. But of course, we have the former chair here, which is Mr. Kasmin. This was first chairman of the commission, and Mr. Colin was introducing him into this function. And later was Peter Crocker from Ireland. So these are the three chairs so far of the three commissions yet to elections. There are two very important documents, and I have them here if anybody wishes to consult. They are also posted on our website. These are the rules of procedure and scientific guidelines. The rules of procedure are important because they are also setting the scheme, how the state, submitting state, interacts with the commission. Of course, the scientific guidelines, you have seen one image from the guidelines, there are others, explain what is necessary, what the submission should contain, and how it should be presented to the commission. Now, going to the Arctic, there are eight states which are considered Arctic states, but only five of them have a direct coast bordering the Arctic Ocean. What I wanted to say that you can see in many, many instances the references to the sectors. I would like to point out that the sectors are not maritime boundaries. Yeah. They serve a different purpose, but they shouldn't be mistaken for maritime boundaries in the Arctic. The maritime boundaries have yet to be determined in most cases. In some cases, they've been negotiated. I'll show it later. And the regime of the Arctic Ocean is, as any other body of water, subject to the regime of UNCLOS. That has been clearly stated, recently agreed among the five coastal states in Greenland. Now, this is how it looks on Google Earth, and of course, it's probably the least controversial image. And we see the Arctic Ocean, I don't see that any ice cover, but it's probably showing it during a period which is less ice cover than normally. Now, this is how it looked to the drafters of the convention on the map. This is just a zoom in. And you can see the potential for the extended continental shelf as illustrated during the third conference in the late 70s. And then you see the area calculation of the 200 nautical miles and plus potential application of various constraints and various criteria. What I would like to say that this map has been prepared in cooperation with LaMent Observatory in New York State. It's a very instrumental. They also produced a very beautiful Mary Thorpe, I think was her name. She was producing a very beautiful map of the seabed. I would like really to recommend to your attention. It's one of the most beautiful maps we have ever seen of the seabed. Now, this is how it looks in the Arctic Ocean more or less today. And this, of course, this is a map which has been roughly prepared by our GIS officer for this purpose. So to the extent possible, it should be accurate, but not necessarily in all details. This is the negotiated line between the United States and the Soviet Union, now the Russian Federation, which is not yet in force. The Duma has not yet ratified because they consider it probably it's not in their best interest, or some deputies at least. We have some boundaries negotiated in this area. We have also some maritime boundaries which are in place here. And then here we have the Norwegian view how the boundaries between Norway and Russia should be, and then the Russian view in yellow. And also we have the areas, the banana hole, as they call it, and then the hole in the Barents Sea, and then this whole area in the Arctic beyond 200 nautical miles. And now this is to be, of course, this is the water column is subject to the regime of the high seas. But whatever is underneath has yet to be determined, and it'll take time. It'll take time for a simple reason. I'm just going back to this Hillside Declaration, which only shows and stresses that the legal framework is the convention. And I'll be done my material. The reason is that the Russian submission to the Commission in 2001 has not yet been resolved. The Commission didn't issue the recommendations. Actually, the Commission did issue recommendations, but only stating that the Russia should come back with additional data. The reason why is here. That's a map which is on our website from 2001. And those who have been so mesmerized by the flag on the North Pole will see that actually in 2001, Russia made it clear in their proposed outer limits that based on their conclusions, this is all the continental shelf of the Russian Federation beyond 200 miles. That was not yet, the recommendations of the Commission were different. The U.S. objected, of course, very strongly. The Commission decided to disregard the comments by the United States, while ultimately the Commission, by their own conclusion, decided that they need to know more about this subsoil, about the nature of especially two features, and these are Mendeleev and Omolosov ridges, or rise, or elevations, however you want to call them, because this is not important. Here, the Commission actually agreed that this is clearly of continental origin, and that Russia can have, the moment they agree on delimitation with Norway, they can have this piece of continental shelf as the shelf over which they exercise sovereign rights and jurisdiction in the Barents Sea. Again, you see here the line of provisional line of delimitation with the United States. That's the Commission in the composition in 2001. Actually, these are the members of the subcommission working on that submission. The late secretary of the Commission and one of our GIS officers, and current chair, Mr. Albuquerque. So as I stated, in 2002, the Commission provided its conclusions and presented the conclusions to the Russian Federation. The Russian Federation has yet to come back to the Commission. According to the news reports, they plan to do it in 2011. They plan to spend 2009 negotiating and talking to other coastal states and trying to convince them of their position, according to what I've seen in the press. And this is what I've already stated. Norway also made its submission to the Commission in 2006. I won't be able to say much about that because this is still under the consideration. I have the privilege of being the secretary of the subcommission, so I've been sitting in the exchanges and witnessing the exchanges between the state and the Commission. So I can just tell you that whatever you will see on the maps, these are the Norwegian baselines in Svalbard, whatever you'll see on that, not necessarily what's going to come out from the Commission, but I think they are on a good track and they may complete the recommendations this year. And Norway proposed in the Arctic, this is the sliver of the continental shelf in the Arctic Ocean, and of course the Barents Sea, which shouldn't be a big problem because of the decision. The Commission will probably follow the same logic as in the case of the Russian Federation, acknowledging the continental nature of this or that part and following. This is a Western Nansen Basin, and you'll see in greater detail the proposed outer limit of Norway in that region. Now, we have three other coastal states, Canada, Denmark, and the United States. You'll see that by virtue of the 10-year limit after the entry into force for that state or the UNCLOS, Canada has up to December 2003, Denmark up to December 2004 to make its submission, and the United States has yet to exceed. So it'll take time, and because there is a queue already building up for submissions, it's no guarantee that even these two will be taken up immediately. So you can expect that it'll take about 20 years at least to finalize, in my assessment, my humble assessment, to finalize and to have a final and binding decision on these limits. And it's an optimistic, I think it's quite optimistic, assessment. And finally, what we do for the Commission, we provide legal logistical support, and this is something which might be of interest to the experts present. We do this compilation 3D modeling, all the technical background. This is what we provide as services, in addition to of course, all the important services. I think that's stalled. Anyhow, we also do analysis of 3D data, etc. So in a nutshell, that was my presentation. Of course, I skipped so many important elements, but at least I managed to illustrate a little bit the current situation as where we stand with the continental shelf and its delineation in the Arctic Ocean. Thank you very much.
Hear from Professor Mayer.
Thank you very much, and I too want to thank you all for the invitation here. I'm, as you can tell just from my dress, I'm not a lawyer. I'm a geologist, geophysicist, but it's always very, very exciting for me to come to fora like this and interact with the lawyers, because the thing that's so exciting about the Law of the Sea Treaty is that it's this wonderful fusion of science and law. And it mixes, as we've heard already, the ambiguities of law with the ambiguities of science. And science is often an ambiguous field. And when we talk about Article 76 and the continental shelf, it's really the ambiguities of geology and earth science. And again, that's an even more ambiguous part of science. And when we apply this all to the Arctic, we're talking about an area that we know very, very little about. And so it just enhances that uncertainty even more. And so it makes it very, very exciting to live in this world of wonderful ambiguity and all kinds of possibilities. And it's really, in a sense, exploration. And so I'm going to talk about the mapping aspects of it. And I think the two previous speakers have presented a wonderful background for that. We've heard about Article 76. It's really just 617 words, and they redefine. Here's where the lawyers step in and take what we geologists for years knew what it meant, the continental shelf, and new lawyers have totally redefined it for us, and it adds to the conflict and adds to the interesting aspects of it. We've heard that a coastal state is entitled to sovereign rights over the resources of the seabed and subsoil of these submerged extensions of the continental margin beyond 200 nautical miles. And as Vlad described, it's based on a series of formula and limit lines. But you first have to demonstrate this idea of a natural prolongation of the coastal state's territorial landmass. And that's kind of easy to do when you have a very, very broad continental shelf, geologic continental shelf, or a thick sedimentary wedge, a thick bunch of sediments. And if we take a look at the kind of broad shelves on the United States on the East Coast, you can see what this concept of natural prolongation, the 200-mile limit would have been somewhere in here, but with this concept of natural prolongation, we can go a bit further. If we look at the West Coast and many margins down South America, these are very, very narrow margins, and they don't have that capability. So that's where it's obvious. Myron has passed out a version of, come on, backwards there, of this map here. This was very early, 2001, our first look at where there was potential for an extension of the U.S. margin. It's where we have these broad shelves, little donut holes in the Gulf of Mexico, the Bering Sea. Gulf of Alaska, a potential there, and you saw in the early map, that was one area where the early conveners of the convention thought there was an extension. We also think there's potential extensions in some of the Pacific Islands, and it's been updated. As we learn more, we're updating. There is even a place here where there's a potential now where the Mendocino Fracture Zone comes in. And so this is an evolving process. If we look to the Arctic, though, we see the Arctic's really unique as an ocean basin, and that's because 52% of it is made up of geologic continental shelf, not even extended shelf, but just geologic shelf. And its closest neighbor in terms of ocean basins is about 7%. So suddenly the Arctic is a very special place because so much of it is made up of continental shelf, geologic continental shelf. We also, have we seen, It's unique in that it's a semi-enclosed basin with the five coastal states that have potential extended shelves. And if we think about this, and Vlad has shown you some initial pictures of what some of these submissions look like, inevitably, and this is a study that's been done at Durham University, inevitably, these extensions are going to overlap, and they're going to be disputed issues. But that becomes a maritime boundary issue, and that's where you guys are going to keep working for years, because it's going to go on and on. It's not really a function of the geology as much as it is of where you establish the boundary. In order to do this, in order to set the framework, as Vlad described, you need to basically measure the depth and the shape of the seafloor. Vlad described the foot of the slope and the 2,500 meter contour as the two critical pieces. You need to measure the thickness of the underlying sediment, this Gardner line. This is the Hedberg line and the Gardner line. And then you have to measure distances from the territorial sea baselines, 350 miles. So the bottom line is that the first step in this whole issue of a submission for an extended continental shelf is mapping the seafloor. And that's where the work that we come in. And people have been mapping the seafloor for thousands and thousands of years. This is a statue that was found in an Egyptian tomb, 2000 BC, and there's this poor little guy up here with a hunk of probably rock instead of lead at the end of a line, and his job was to throw it over the side for the papyrus raft to make sure they didn't run aground and measure how deep it is. A lead line. The next picture I was able to find was something like 3,400 years later, wood carving from the Thames River, and there they are again, measuring the depth of the ocean with a hunk of lead at the end of the rope. So 3,400 years, there was really no change in the technology to measure how deep the oceans were, just this lead at the end of a rope. If I now jump 500 years ahead and see how techniques have changed, go to 1940, and see it's exactly the same. And that's really the bottom line. For over 4,000 years, the only way to measure how deep it was in the ocean was to throw a hunk of lead at the end of a rope and see how long it was before it hit bottom. Clearly very inaccurate, very slow. About the time of the Second World War, echo sounders became perfected. You can send a pulse of sound down, measure how much time it takes to go to the bottom and back. If you know how fast sound travels in the water, you can measure how deep it is. Much, much quicker. But that sound actually travels in a big, big cone on the seafloor, and so you insonify a very large area, something like the water depth, so 3,000 meters of water, that circle's 3,000 meters wide, and you don't know where that depth came from in that circle. You just get one depth, and what we can do is put together a kind of a nice two-dimensional picture of what the ocean depth looks like that, but it's really very sparse lines separated by large distances. And from that combination of those lead lines and these single-beam echo sounders, we put together the kind of standard navigational charts we see. For those of you who are sailors, that's what you sail on. People have gone and selected shoal soundings and used their imagination to draw lines. We call them contours on here. And in the deep sea version of this, we put together what we call bathymetric charts. Coming out of where I used to live in San Diego, all the ship tracks coming out, each one of them with one of those echo sounders, and somebody uses their imagination, connects the dots, and draws these contours. And that's the kind of depiction we had of the seafloor up until just a few years ago. And I'll jump to the new technology in a minute. But with these techniques, how do you map in conditions like this? And that's what we face in the Arctic. I know we've heard all about the ice melting and everything, but believe me, there's still a lot of ice left, and it's still a very difficult place to map. If we look at early maps of the Arctic, and this looks like a very, very early map, it was thought that the Arctic actually was a large landmass. There was seas surrounding it, but around the North Pole was a large continental block. And the interesting thing is that idea held until the beginning of the 20th century. And it took Friedrich Nansen and his remarkable experiment of a drift of the Fram locking in the ice. In that drift, he made 8 lead line soundings. That's what he was able to do over 3 years. 8 measurements of depth. And talk about a brilliant fellow. From those 8 measurements of depth, and you can see him here, 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 here. He drew this map, published in 1907, that showed a deep ocean basin. I have no idea how he extrapolated, but he was a lot closer to right than the previous maps. So that was the picture in 1907. Since that time, There have been ice islands. The Russians led with a number of ice islands. The Americans had an ice island that floated around for 13 years. People lived on those ice islands. They dug holes. They would put an echo sounder in the hole, and it would very slowly float around, and one at a time, depth measurements made. You can send planes and helicopters. Again, you have to stop, dig a hole in the ice, make a single measurement. And from that accumulation of individual measurements, about 60,000 of them, that's all there were over many years, in the late 60s and 70s, the Canadian Hydrographic Service and an organization called JEBCO put together the first very, very blurry, and that's intentionally blurry because they didn't know very well what was going on, pictures of what we thought was going on in the Arctic basins. And this is about the time that the convention was being developed. So this was their picture of the Arctic basin at that time. At the same time, there were submarines transiting under the ice quite a bit. They would occasionally turn on their echo sounders and collect data. It took a number of years and a lot of people working very hard to do it, but that data started to be declassified, and the submarine tracks from 1983 to 1988 were released. And that added a lot to the database, although, as I'll point out, it's actually quite inaccurate data. The submarines really didn't know where they were. They don't navigate. They don't come to the surface. They have an inertial navigation system that drifts, and they can be many miles off. But from that collection of data, an organization called the International Bathymetric Chart of the Arctic Ocean, IBCAO, created this compilation in 1999. And it was done from a student, actually, at the University of Stockholm, who then came to our university as a postdoc and a researcher, Martin Jacobson, who really was the major compiler of this. And he made a beautiful-looking map. But just because it looks beautiful doesn't mean it's right. He's truly an artist. And you talk about Marie Tharp in that same tradition. It's really beautiful, but it's based still, this map still based only about on 100,000 measurements total over an area the size of the Arctic Ocean. As I said, we were stuck with lead line measurements and single beam measurements, single beam sonar measurements, or echo sounder measurements, until just a few years ago. And then a new technique came along, and that technique was called multi-beam echo sounders. And instead of putting just a single ping of sound that would go over a big circle, this would put a wide fan of sound with each many, many, many beams, each one with very high resolution, across a wide swath. And suddenly, the way we can collect information about the seafloor changed radically. We went from this kind of sparse single lines here, I'll block people over here for a while, to suddenly multiple measurements of very, very high resolution. And this really, really changed our whole perspective of the seafloor. We went from a map that looked like that to now being able to create a picture like that. And that's the harbor of Portsmouth. That's the Portsmouth Harbor where I live. And in the deep sea version, we went from our picture of what Southern California looked like, the offshore of Southern California, like that, to one like that. As it says, new perspectives provide new insights. It's just a whole new revolution in terms of the way we can look at the seafloor. Despite the fact that the U.S. hasn't acceded to the treaty, there has been interest for a long time. As I said, we've followed most of the rules, and the U.S. has been interested in collecting the data necessary. And in 2001, our lab was asked to do a study of where new data may need to be collected. And what we really concluded is that everywhere except for the Arctic, the U.S. actually had enough data in its existing database to make a submission. These new sonars weren't even developed when the commission wrote the rules. They don't require that kind of new data. But we also argued that if we could collect this new data, not only would we do wonderful things about our understanding of the Earth and the oceans, but we actually couldn't optimize any submission that we make because we can see all the detail. We'd have an unambiguous picture of what the seafloor looked like. And the government bought that. And so since 2003, we've been mapping in all these different areas, also in the Western Pacific, over 1 million square kilometers of seafloor mapped. And in each case, this difference between the early depiction of the seafloor and what we see now has been remarkable. Here's the Beringian margin in the Bering Sea. That's the best picture we had before we went and mapped there in 2003. And that's what it looks like for real. And you can see from this concept of natural prolongation and promontories how it's so, so different that we would have to put a foot of the slope, if we can define one, somewhere in here. But now we can carry that out much, much further. And there is an aspect of the treaty that says you can connect points by 60 nautical mile straight line segments, which means you can connect. would give you a tremendous advantage. And that was our logic in trying to collect this full coverage, multi-beam echo sounded data. The Atlantic, where we think we know the area very well, we thought we did, that's what it looked like before. That's what it looks like now. Again, a whole new world of processes for those of us who want to understand the Earth. Just this amazing look at what the seafloor processes are looking like. And so then we try to apply that to the Arctic. And we're very fortunate in the U.S. to have an icebreaker, the Healy. And this icebreaker has one of these multi-beam echo sounders on it. Not the best one in the world, but it has one at least. But we didn't know if we can actually do this together. Can you combine breaking ice, which is a very noisy process, just the act of breaking ice is noisy, with trying to listen to sound go out there and back. It doesn't like external noise. And so in 2003, we headed out to this region here where we think there's clearly a natural prolongation, the Chukchi Plateau, and the brilliant, maybe Professor Moore can comment on it a little later, the brilliant U.S. negotiators actually had a statement made that the Chukchi Plateau was not a submarine ridge, and that was not refuted during the early negotiations. So it's not constrained by the 350 nautical mile limit that Vlad discussed. In 2003, we set out just on a 10-day trip to see if we can do this. Could we just head up to, this is the U.S.-Russian line, and start finding in this region beyond 350 nautical miles here, we'll be able to use a second cutoff, which is a 2,500-meter contour plus 100 nautical miles. Don't worry about the details. But we wanted to find that 2,500-meter depth contour. And so could we do it? And what we found in 2003 was lots of ice coverage, but it was soft and what the ice pressure people call cheesy ice, very easy to break through. And while we had planned that having to go at 3 knots, 3 nautical miles an hour, we were actually able to make about 6 nautical miles an hour. And we're able quite nicely. Here's the track of the ship. The white line is the 2,500-meter contour. So we found we were able in real time to drive along and follow this depth contour, which is a critical component of the limit line. This red line is where we thought earlier from that beautiful map where we thought it was. And you see it's quite different. And you can see how promontory to promontory you can really extend any potential submission. We also discovered a seamount came from 4,000 meters up to less than 900 meters, totally unmapped, and 2 U.S. submarines had crossed right over it. And it's not that they didn't see it. It's that they weren't where they thought they were. We finally figured out they were 5 miles off, again, because their navigation drifts. And there are many and many of these out there. With that success, we planned a trip in 2004 where we were going to finish up the 2,500-meter contour and then look for that foot of the slope. But in 2004, that's the kind of conditions we hit. And we got hard stuck, basically, and beat our way up. We're 18, 20 hours, just couldn't make any progress, drifting towards the North Pole. And when we finally broke through, retreated back and mapped off the barrel margin. So again, even though there's a general degradation of the ice, it really depends on the local wind conditions at the time. The next trip we went on was in 07. We now had 30 days, and we expected to be able to do this exploration for where the foot of the slope might be, thinking that it was the edge of Chukchi Plateau from our existing maps. And what we found was this, and this was really the remarkable change. We basically saw the breakup of the permanent ice pack. And this was really a very, very interesting phenomena. This is thick multi-year ice, the same ice that had held us up in 2004, but now for the first time just broken up. So it was quite easy to maneuver through. So very good for mapping, but very, very bad for the Arctic. And if you remember, our plan was to map just in here. What we ended up doing was getting up way beyond 83 north, because as we mapped in this region, looking for that foot of the slope, we couldn't find it. Here's a perspective view. These were our lines looking for the foot of the slope. And as we came across, I'll look at a little section here. This is something else, an instrument that looks below the seafloor, and you see these sediments here that are just what we call conformable. They just drape like this, and this is not what you expect at the transition from the deep sea onto the continental shelf. So it just wasn't there. And so given the ice conditions, we were able to keep going, and this is what we found way out here, and that's exactly what you expect, this very flat-lying material that stops abruptly. That's a foot of the slope. And so our thought of where the foot of the slope was before we left was here. We actually found it way out here. And this has obviously important ramifications because the foot of the slope is the starting point for all of the extension, potential extension lines. Just to take a look at how abrupt that is, it's actually quite remarkable. And this is an unambiguous foot of the slope. Sometimes it's very ambiguous, but I don't think there's much of a question here about where the foot of the slope is. And it continues on. So that was 2007 with this remarkable change, which has great ramifications on both the US, Canadian, and potentially even the Russian extension. Last year, we went up to continue that even further. We found that it got very, very complicated up here, and we still don't know what goes on. But for the first time, we also took samples. We did something called dredging, a very, very sophisticated technique of a big just chain bag at the end of a wire rope that you drag 3,000, 4,000 meters on the bottom and hope you come up with some rocks. And we did, remarkably. We took a series of dredge stations here, and they came up to be rocks that were not oceanic. They were actually shallow continental material. And this, again, will have great ramifications on the geologic origin. It actually changes many of the existing views of the geologic origin of these features, and will have ramifications, again, on the Russian and Canadian submissions also. We also, for the first time last year, did a joint exercise. Vlad talked about this expensive part of collecting seismic data, extremely difficult in the Arctic. We've just been measuring depth here, but the subsurface stuff has been real difficult. And so we had a joint exercise with a Canadian vessel where they would collect seismic data in the US area, and we would break ice for them when they collected it there, the Louis Saint-Laurent. And I basically wanted to end with that because I've just, returned from a meeting in Halifax where we're planning next year's 42-day expedition up there. And the national interests have just evaporated. It's really wonderful. We're planning a mission to map the seafloor. There's only one shape of the seafloor. There's only one set of sediment thickness. As scientists, it should be our job to map that and then let the diplomats, the politicians, the lawyers argue about boundaries. That's a different issue. But from a scientific perspective, we should be working collaboratively, particularly in an area as difficult to work as this, and that's exactly what evolved. We're now just planning ECS missions that are joint Canadian-US, and we'll map for them, they'll map for us, and it's really evolving into a wonderful precedent, despite the fact that US and Canada will have difficult boundary issues, but the bottom line is to find out what the scientific truth is. And so the tradition usually is to end with a sunset picture on an oceanographic trip, a cruise. This is actually a sunrise and sunset picture. There was a sun rising and setting. It's just all in a matter of minutes. So let me end there, and I'll. I have a whole bunch of 3D flying stuff that we could do. But I'll just show you that at the end, just to give you an idea of these margins. You see how broad the margins are. But when we come up to the Arctic, it's overwhelming in terms of the shelf distribution here. It's unlike any other ocean basin. And you see the nations without broad margins, particularly in the Western Pacific, have a much, much more difficult case, the island nations in particular. And later, we have that high-resolution map of the Arctic that we can come back up and explore real quick. So thank you.
Don't show the little scribblings at the bottom. That won't show up. That's great.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, my cryptic little notes at the bottom. Well, thank you to Vanderbilt and the Transnational Law Journal. I must say the organization has been terrific. I'm not sure I've ever been to a conference where anybody was more organized than Peter Marshall or more diligent about keeping in touch. And we appreciate that very much. As Vladimir mentioned, there are established treaty rules and procedures involving this commission on the limits of the continental shelf to set the limits of the shelf where it extends beyond 200 miles. The system for setting these limits in the Arctic is really no different from the system for setting the limits elsewhere. And I think that's an important point about the Arctic. A lot of the law of the sea rules that apply there, including the dispute settlement rules, are really the same as apply to any other part of the oceans. This is an overview of my topic. I actually became interested in this through my work as the U.S. member of the International Law Association's Committee on Legal Issues of the Outer Continental Shelf, which has issued a couple of extensive reports. Most of those reports examined in detail the wording of Article 76, but dispute settlement was something we looked at very briefly. In a nutshell, my view is that there are some rather limited third-party dispute settlement options that may be available to assess the legality of outer limits of the continental shelf, but there are significant problems with these options, and these difficulties, these problems suggest, I think, we should look elsewhere to promote legal accuracy and consistency of outer limits beyond 200 miles. For my introduction, I'll try to go through this very briefly and get to the meat of my talk pretty quickly. We've already heard some expert analysis of Article 76 and the Commission. I just want to highlight a few points here. As Myron mentioned, there's really a fundamental distinction between entitlement to the continental shelf, which is guaranteed, and setting the outer limit of the continental shelf, which is my concern. The CLCS has this so-called watchdog role in terms of providing recommendations concerning the outer limit. That does not substitute for the right of each coastal state to actually set the outer limit. The Commission does not actually set the limit, it offers recommendations. This point hasn't been mentioned. Vladimir mentioned the official roles of the Commission. I think there's an inevitable associated role. And that is that the Commission, in order to carry out its functions, has to interpret and apply the Law of the Sea Convention. And broadly, one of my concerns is, well, what helps to assure that the Commission does so accurately and consistently? Coastal states would like to follow the CLCS recommendations, set their limits on the basis of those recommendations, because a limit set on the basis of is going to be final and binding. States may disagree. We have a disagreement involving Russia in the Arctic, and the convention talks about a resubmission to the CLCS if there's a disagreement. The next two slides, I confess, in light of Larry's presentation, I'm embarrassed about. They're not mine, but they are based on some work by Ron McNabb. And Ron, I think, would admit that, A, these maps were provisional, and B, I think the data that he used came from about 2001, before these later expeditions. But I show them to highlight the potential for disputes. This dotted line is a 200-mile limit. These dark shaded areas were Ron's view, published in a book. You'll notice the expert company here by Myron and John. These dark areas are the areas that would be outside the continental shelf limits if we followed Russia's view. if we followed what Ron thought was likely the view of the CLCS when it acted in 2002, we see much more extensive areas that would be outside the limits of the continental shelf. My last point in introduction, I think these points have really implicitly been made, but you might subtitle this slide, "Who Cares?" I mean, who cares where the outer limits of the continental shelf is? We think, I'm not to my who cares slide yet. this is just to emphasize that when we're talking about limits, I'm concerned with the outer limit, the boundary between a coastal state's continental shelf and the community seabed, if you will, out beyond. I'm not concerned with limits or delimitation of boundaries between, in the case of the Arctic, adjacent states. Basically, the CLCS keeps its hands off matters involving unresolved maritime boundary delimitations. There are several options for states that have unresolved boundaries when they seek to make CLCS submissions. But I'm going to be concerned with the outer limit. Here's my who cares slide. Obviously, coastal states care because they have sovereign rights over the continental shelf resources. That's a primary interest. But there's a huge range of non-coastal state rights that are affected by the location of the outer limits of the continental shelf. The International Seabed Authority and the so-called common heritage interest in the area. Obviously, there are implications there for about the extent of that interest, depending on where the outer limit is drawn. And there may be other community interests as well. Here's my take on third-party tribunals and the continental shelf, the outer limits of the continental shelf. My view is that tribunals can help to promote legal accuracy and other what I've called rule of law values. The Law of the Sea Convention, in fact, does provide some possible role for third-party tribunals in addressing outer limit cases, but there are several factors that would constrain these tribunals if they were ever faced with a case, and we should focus on other ways, not involving tribunals, to promote rule of law values. When I talk about legal accuracy, the question with respect to a coastal state is pretty straightforward. Does a coastal state comply with Law of the Sea Convention rules, both procedural and substantive, with respect to the outer limit of the continental shelf? This question is, in a sense, a subset of this question. We also can raise legal accuracy questions about the CLCS. I suppose there's a threshold question. It's a technical scientific body. It's a non-adjudicatory body. Should it accurately interpret and apply Article 76? I believe the answer to that is yes. It inevitably does engage in legal functions, and it's appropriate to ask whether the commission proceeds accurately. I'm going to focus on just the legal accuracy component. There are other values that I put under the heading of rule of law values that are different from accuracy. This one sometimes gets confused with legal accuracy, but they're clearly different. One may be accurate but inconsistent. If there is a range of permissible views that could be legally accurate, one may be perfectly consistent, but also inaccurate. So, legal accuracy is a concern with respect to the actions of coastal states, with respect to the actions of the CLCS. I think it's also a concern with the actions, with respect to the actions of tribunals. We have in the Law of the Sea Law of the Sea Convention, a comprehensive system of dispute settlement involving roles for third-party tribunals that have obligatory jurisdiction. We evaluate these tribunals themselves, I think, in terms of rule of law values. Is it properly interpreting the scope of its own jurisdiction, properly interpreting legal rules? This third-party dispute settlement system was promoted in the convention to further some very important goals, promoting compliance with the convention by other actors, and also authoritatively articulating the meaning of convention norms. So in a sense, there's potentially a tension here. We might say we would like tribunals to be able to review the legal accuracy of an outer limit set by the coastal state, or review the outer limit of recommendations by the CLCS. On the other hand, we may be skeptical about that review if it would exceed the tribunal's own jurisdiction. A few points. There's not time to go into detail about the dispute settlement system, but there are a few forums that at least at first glance might be plausible forums for reviewing the outer limits of the continental shelf. An arbitral tribunal under Part 15 of the convention can hear interstate contentious cases. There are a few topics that are limited or excluded from the jurisdiction of these tribunals. And if you kind of run down the list of the areas where there are some limitations, we don't see outer limits on that list. Maritime delimitation matters between adjacent states or opposite states are subject to an optional exclusion, but there is no stated exception for outer limits. When we come to the Seabed Disputes Chamber that deals with disputes with respect to activities in the area, though, I think we should be very skeptical about the potential for the use of that chamber to review outer limit claims. The reason is because this phrase, activities in the area, is a term of art that refers to exploration or exploitation of mineral resources and does not encompass disputes over the establishment of an outer limit. And there are some possibilities for advisory opinions as well. Can we decipher this? This was my effort to make sense of different dispute settlement options. My analysis depends on some parsing of treaty text, and my conclusions, I should note, are the subject of some debate by folks who have looked at this. But still, if we look at, you know, who might bring a claim against whom, with respect to what types of issues, a few things do become clear. There is no role for the CLCS in this dispute settlement process. So if there, if we were really at loggerheads over a dispute, let's say with Russia, disagreeing with recommendations of the CLCS, we could not proceed. I'm going to skip the advisory jurisdiction slide, and we'll discuss that if there's time. But I've already been waved at. Five minutes? Okay. In summary, when you have the CLCS, the ISA, seabed authority, or private parties, there is no prospect, I think, for obligatory jurisdiction. The most promising cases, possible cases, are one where a directly affected non-coastal state challenges an outer limit on the grounds that it is not set on the basis of a CLCS recommendation and did not comply with Article 76. I think there have to be some possibilities for a directly affected non-coastal state also to challenge a CLCS recommendation. Suppose, give you one brief hypothetical. Suppose the CLCS recommends an outer limit that is inside a coastal state's 350-mile cutoff according to that state's version of its strait baselines. Suppose this coastal state goes ahead and sets its outer limit using precisely the CLCS's recommendations. But what if the strait baseline is illegal? Suppose that using a legal baseline, the CLCS's recommended limit would be outside a 350-mile cutoff. In a case like that, I think a non-coastal state should be able to challenge the outer limit that the coastal state went ahead and set, technically, on the basis of a CLCS recommendation. There may be some real, as we've seen, jurisdictional limits to the ability of tribunals to hear cases. There may be some political issues that would constrain these cases. I think, as well, there are what I've called practical or judicial competence limits involving the ability of a tribunal to assess or reassess the complex sort of data. It's really an application of facts to law. So what are the alternatives that could promote legal accuracy and other rule of law values? This option is difficult in the extreme, not a real action. I think we need to look at actions by the CLCS itself and actions by coastal states. Larry's referred to cooperation in data gathering. Certainly if states agreed on that the same data was appropriate to use, that could help eliminate disputes and promote accuracy. The CLCS, in fact, has implemented some changes. It now releases detailed summaries of its recommendations, something that it did not used to do. My last question, again, is in a sense a political question. Maybe our sense is that the CLCS system works well enough, at least so far, and that concern with finality means we needn't pause and concern ourselves too closely with exactly how accurate these determinations are. In conclusion, I would say third-party dispute settlement is a valuable option for promoting this legal accuracy. The Law of the Sea Convention does allow some third-party review. concerning continental shelf outer limit decisions, particularly in interstate cases, challenging a limit set by a state on challenging on the grounds it was not made on the basis of a CLCS decision. But there are some pretty strong constraints that I think affect the ability of tribunals to handle outer limit cases. And those constraints suggest to me that legal accuracy and these other values may best be promoted through alternatives to formal dispute settlement. Thanks for your attention.
So we have about 10 minutes or so for questions. So I'd invite the panelists to come back up so that we can have a bit of a discussion, which will obviously continue throughout the day. And I thought this was fascinating on many levels. And I have lots of questions, but I'm going to only ask one and take the prerogative of the chair to do that as the panelists are coming back to our discussion. And that really relates to well, one observation and then one question. The observation is, it strikes me, and please correct me if I'm wrong, so it's a sort of a general question, that notwithstanding, John, your statement, I think it was very good to bring in the sort of community interests and third-party interests, but what really seems to be driving the process in the Arctic is conflicts between coastal states over the division of the spoils, if you put it, to put it crudely, rather than the sort of exercise of determining what's territorial, what's controlled by one country versus the commons. And in the Law of the Sea negotiations, my impression is that issues with respect to the commons figured much more formally. And I was struck by one of your maps where you said, okay, this is what Russia says, assuming that's sort of an aggressive claim, and this is what's outside, you know, of the outer continental shelf if a different version is adopted. And I'm sure that's an awful lot of, you know, sea and continental shelf there, but it was not an enormous difference relative to the Arctic as a whole, which just highlighted for me in part what the dynamics were. But my question that I invite any of the panelists to consider really relates to the status of the U.S. as a non-party and how important ratification of the Law of the Sea Treaty is on this specific question. And so we started out with a discussion, a point that Professor Nordquist raised, that the U.S. has followed the treaty extremely closely, sometimes more closely than some of the parties, and that certainly has some historical precedent in terms of as a statement of what the U.S. practice has been. But here we have a mechanism, the Commission, that seems to have particular relevance for parties or particular rights and perhaps obligations for parties. And I'm wondering whether the U.S. can stay as a non-party and still get the benefits of that. So I'll throw that out and so to see what the panelists' reaction to there, and then I'm happy to take other questions. John, do you want to get us started?
I'll take a first swipe at this. The rules about submissions to the CLCS are different from most of the rules in the convention because they refer to the possibility of submissions by coastal states, not by state parties. So this question of whether non-parties can take advantage of the CLCS process is a real and live question. You know, there's a legal controversy. What mechanism is available to address that? One of the mechanisms I highlighted on the screen, in fact, has been used with respect to that question. There was an opinion sought from the UN Legal Council by the Commission. And my understanding is that said that we won't decide right now because the issue hasn't arisen. No non-party has tried to submit claims. My personal view is that the far better reading of the convention is that this mechanism is open only to state parties. And that's one of the reasons why I think it is important for the U.S. to participate as a party to the convention.
Heather, yeah, please.
The commission has already rejected comments that the U.S. submitted on the Brazilian proposal, for example, which would indicate that if you can't comment, you're hardly likely to be able to get your claim.
But there is a distinction as to why they rejected those comments. The process in the commission is set up very much as a bilateral process, coastal state and commission. And there is a recognition that states with maritime boundary disputes may comment on those disputes. So when the U.S. was trying to raise concerns with the Brazilian submission, the reaction of the commission, which I think was technically proper, is under our rules, you don't have any potential boundary disputes with Brazil.
That's perhaps something I can even confirm, that the commission is concerned about, always concerned about status and independence. It's a group of independent experts, and then I think that in the commission, my perception was a strong feeling that at least as far as the scientific opinions are concerned, they should be acting in their personal capacity and not to be influenced by any government views on that remark. Definitely the commission, when it examines the submission, my calls for state, they go out and they seek scientific literature. They also, I think, literature which is partly legal, even though, of course, their main focus is science. But that being said, and that also coming into this issue of whether the Commission interprets the Convention or not, it does to a certain extent only, though. Because for major legal issues, then you have this process between the coastal state, submitting coastal state, and the Commission. And whenever the coastal state feels strongly that the Commission sort of errs in its interpretation of one clause, they have the opportunity to come back and say, look, this is a correct interpretation. And we as state have the prerogative, actually, as a state body of the prerogative of interpreting the common clause. In this particular, situation of the U.S., yeah, that's correct. It was a meeting of states parties, actually, which was asked. And the question has arisen during a meeting of states parties. And the conclusion was, we are going to deal with this whenever this problem arises, whenever the coastal state comes. But in real terms, we are faced as a secretariat, performing the functions of the Secretary General when accepting the submissions or even deposits of charts and information, we are faced, it's a practical problem for us. A state non-party comes with a deposit of baselines, with a deposit of outer limits for maritime space, let's say the continental shelf. Shall we accept it or shall we not accept it? There is nothing in the convention which would forbid the Secretary General from doing so. Actually, it has been the practice of the Secretary General to accept, in the case of registration of treaties, even treaties which are being registered by state non-parties or international organizations. So in the sense, and given the mandate that the Secretary General receives from the General Assembly every year to promote UNCLOS, and to promote UNCLOS, it means also among state non-parties, of course, the attitude is more or less positive. In fact, probably if a state comes and a state non-party and say we would like to deposit this outer limit of the continental shelf, you would accept it, because there is no reason for us not to do that. Of course, there will be implied expectation by all of the states and players. This is being conformity with UNCLOS. And that the state actually will be acting now by depositing is accepting the package, in a way, concerning the maritime space.
Okay. Yeah, there's one other aspect of non-accession in terms of a ramification that is potentially very relevant in the Arctic, and that's that the U.S. is certainly excluded from having representation on the CLCS. And in that sense, is not a party to the process by which the adjudication, or that's probably the wrong word, the non-adjudication takes place.
Briefly, John, because I want to get at least one question from the audience before we break, but if you want to.
Well, just to highlight Larry's point, I think this is important. I mean, I get concerned about the extent of confidentiality, non-transparency in the commission. But in practical terms, if the U.S. wants to know the most about what sorts of arguments will work. It certainly would help the U.S. to have a representative on the commission.
One word.
The members of the commission are not supposed to represent anybody. They are experts in their personal capacity, and they are not supposed actually to represent the interests of their own governments. But it helps, yeah, it does.
All right, we'll leave it there. Yes, sir.
I do have a follow-up question to this point. Larry emphasized that this, all of your excellent talks highlight the relationship between law, geology, geography, also technology. So I was amazed by your slides, Larry. I didn't know all of the new technologies that have been developed. Obviously, it struck me that if the commission has submissions and access to this level of technology, they're going to make better decisions than if they don't. So it raises questions, are all the states making submissions, do they have the capacity? My guess is they don't. And so how can the commission make the most high-level accurate determinations? And does that raise questions about sharing technology capacity from states like the U.S.?
I'll try, and then Vlad will give you the real answer. It's a very, very valid point. I think if you look at the guidelines that the CLC has produced, you basically just need to document that the submission you made is as accurate as you can. And there is no requirement for this kind of technology. And I think we've seen a number of submissions. The Australians didn't use this technology at all in their submission. They used the old single beam and certainly had no problem with that. So in that sense, that requirement isn't there, and I think the commission is quite flexible, I would suspect, in terms of the nature of the data that's brought in. In terms of those nations without the capability, there is a fund that the Norwegians, I guess, mostly fund that tries to help developing countries to get access to this technology. And there are a number of mutual efforts going on, but not as much as should be.
Unfortunately, the trust fund doesn't cover that technology, and the acquisition data, no. This is beyond the trust fund is quite limited in its scope, mostly for training, for preparation of documents, for maybe software expertise. It's will be way too expensive to try to cover all these. But on the other hand, yes, the commission can handle any submission of this nature. I would say technologically we are prepared. We have been just recently purchasing software packages of mostly widely used software, carry slots, S3, etc., and licenses for each commissioner. So we can handle all the sophisticated multi-beam situations, 3D mapping, and we provide this support to the commission. The cost is considerable. In terms of the cost of software, it's $2 million only, and that's for the biennium. So the cost, even to the state members of the United Nations, because the bill has been considerable. But on the other hand, you have interest of major coastal states in commission having the best of capacities to accurately verify the proposed outer limit. It doesn't have to be that much sophisticated. For states who have really no capacity to do that, there is no possibility to file preliminary information just to meet the deadline, which for most states is now 2009, this May, 12th of May, and then come later with the due submission. So there is now a kind of breathing space, especially for states which cannot rely on the data which is in public domain, like Interpol, for instance. But also it's possible to make submission on that basis.
Of course, it's more
likely that it's going to come back because of the request for more data in some situations, especially for sediment thickness.
And I think we've seen a number of situations where large countries with the capability have done surveys for developing countries because the incremental cost, if a French vessel is in the South Pacific, the incremental cost for 1 or 2 days of survey is tens of thousands of dollars, not millions of dollars. They don't have to buy the equipment, it's just an incremental cost. The U.S. did that with Bangladesh. 1 day survey to survey $25,000. So.
Well, we're over time already. I know many other interesting questions, and I invite you to join me in thanking the panelists, and then also we have coffee out in where you had breakfast this morning, and we're going to reconvene right at 11. So again, thank you very much. It was fascinating.